Beyond Barbarossa, Episode 54, Prokhorovka, The Impaling. In light of the superior firepower and killing range of the Panther and Tiger, the Soviet T-34 crews had to close in on their enemies as quickly as possible. This was armored warfare at its most brutal, with tanks slugging it out at point-blank range. According to one Soviet veteran, the tanks were as close as 10 to 15 meters. Once hit, many of the crews had little chance of bailing out and were splattered all over the insides of their tanks. Those who did try to escape their blazing tanks were mown down, and their lifeless bodies left obscenely charred and shriveled. Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English-language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Red Beard Studio on traditional Anishinaabeg Algonquin territory, also called Ottawa, Canada. This is episode 54, the fourth part of what has become a series on the Battle of Kursk, the biggest tank battle in history. A battle where over 2 million men, in thousands of tanks and self-propelled guns, and manning artillery and gun emplacements and flying airplanes, or riding on armored personnel carriers or in the backs of tanks, crammed into a front 250 kilometers by 100 kilometers. It was the greatest concentration of armor ever. To help you visualize how this battle developed, you can see maps and photos on the website beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com. Click on the title of the episode, not on the image, to open the page for this episode. So just to sum up where we are now, the Germans had put the 9th Army plus other units at the northern corner of the Kursk Salient or Bulge, which is south of the city of Orel, and then the 4th Panzer Army plus Army Detachment Kempf at the southern corner near the Russian city of Belgorod. These two groups attacked simultaneously at precisely 3:30 a.m., they were German after all, on 5th July 1943. And ran into 8 successive lines of Soviet defenses, anti-tank ditches, bunkers, machine gun nests, barbed wire, trenches, 5,000 tanks, 25,000 guns and mortars, and nearly 2 million soldiers. The past three episodes describe the build-up to the battle, the thinking behind it, and the opening week of fighting. The German plan was to drive from those corners, southward and northward, meet east of Kursk, and create another enormous encirclement of Red Army forces like they had done in 1941 and 1942. The Soviet strategy was simpler, to let the Germans impale themselves on the defenses. And that's exactly what happened for the first 7 days of this battle. For a week, the Germans ground against the successive lines of defense, causing huge casualties, but not making much progress. In the north, the 9th Army made, at best, over those 7 days, 9 miles, but only at its farthest point. Most units made maybe 2 to 3 miles. On 10th July, as I mentioned last episode, German generals Model and Kluge admitted they would not reach their objective, which was Kursk. But they decided to keep fighting, to keep pressure, in order to support Army Group South. There, Hoth's 4th Panzer Army, which included the infamous 2nd SS Panzer Corps, consisting of the Death's Head, Adolf Hitler, and Das Reich Panzer Divisions, had penetrated farther, reaching the edge of the strategically located town of Prokhorovka, as well as cutting off the highway leading to the city of Oboyan, which was almost halfway to their objective of Kursk. Now, if the Germans could take Prokhorovka, they could open up the way to Oboyan, which was about halfway or almost halfway to their goal, Kursk. And at this point, by the 10th or 11th of July, they had reached the Red Army's last line of defense. So the Stavka, the Soviet high command, played its trump card size. Even with 1.5 million fighting men concentrated into that salient, they had more to bring in. On 5th July, Stavka ordered its reserve front, previously called the Steppe Front, into the breach. Along came the 5th Guards Army and the 5th Guards Tank Army, which is a separate unit, commanded by one Pavel Rotmistrov. They arrived at the edge of a forest just east of Prokhorovka on 11th July. That's where last episode left off. Pavel Rotmistrov, commander of the 5th Guards Tank Army, looking over the Prokhorovka battlefront in the early morning of 11th July. To see SS panzers moving on the ground where he had planned to have his army form up. So he scrambled back to his field headquarters to make new plans and issue new orders. At 600 hours, 12th July, 1943, Rotmistrov and his senior officers settled into an observation post on a hill southwest of Prokhorovka. I'm going to quote from Robin Cook's book, Citadel, The Battle of Kursk. Quote, below the command post stretched an undulating plain, golden with wheat fields in the rays of the early morning sun, dotted with copses and cultivated plots, and cut with ravines. Beyond the wheat fields ran the dark line of the forest in which the 2nd SS Panzer Corps' army was lagered. Concealed in the corn around it were the anti-tank guns and tank destroyers of the 5th Guards Tank Army. End quote. Then thunderstorms broke out. Even so, at 6:30 hours, the 8th Flieger Corps, the Luftflotte unit assigned to provide air support to Hoth's 4th Panzer Army, began its bombardment of the front lines. The Red Air Force responded with fighters to drive off the Stuka dive bombers. At 8:30, Soviet bombers and artillery began their bombardment. Then Katyusha rocket launchers were fired. When the German panzers emerged from their forest cover, Rotmistrov yelled a phrase that has become part of the lore of Kursk. Stall! 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 Steel! Sent two tank corps to meet the panzers. Once again, I can't do better than Robin Cook's description. Quote, from the moment the leading elements of the Soviet armor crashed through the 2nd SS Panzer Corps' first echelon, the commanders on both sides lost all control of their formations, and the battle became a confused free-for-all in which every tank and its crew fought individually amid a packed mass of armor, like knights on a 15th century battlefield. End quote. In other words, it was a complete melee of tanks, while air duels continued overhead. Neither side's artillery nor air forces could intervene on the ground without risking hitting their own side. Some 300 German panzers and self-propelled guns tangled with about 700 Soviet tanks and self-propelled guns. Once again, while the Germans faced a 2-to-1 disadvantage in numbers, they were on the offensive. The hubris of the high command. But on the ground, the thinking was different. Again, from Robin Cook. Here he quotes a German soldier who was at the battle. "We had been warned to expect resistance from PAC, fixed anti-tank guns, and some tanks in static positions. Also the possibility of a few independent brigades of the slower KV type. In fact, we found ourselves taking on a seemingly inexhaustible mass of enemy armor. Never have I received such an overwhelming impression of Russian strength and numbers as on that day. The clouds of dust made it difficult to get help from the Luftwaffe, and soon many of the T-34s had broken past our screen and were streaming like rats all over the battlefield." End quote. This tactic of charging into the fray made the Tiger tanks and elephants' advantages of distance irrelevant. That is, the 1 kilometer range of the Tiger's 88mm gun. Up close, the T-34's gun, which was slightly smaller, 76mm, and had a shorter range, could have a devastating impact. While the Tigers had almost impenetrable 150mm thick armor in front, the armor was thinner on the sides and the back at 80mm or 3.1 inches. Also on top. This made the Tigers vulnerable to aerial bombing, but that wasn't happening very much in this battle, but also to shells fired from the side or the back, such as from a hidden anti-tank gun that could shoot the Tigers and Panzers as they went by. The result was, as you could expect, a chaos of wheeling, turning, and burning tanks. German author Franz Kurowski quotes a certain Obersturmbannführer, or SS platoon commander, named Rudolf von Ribbentrop. Yes, the son of that Ribbentrop, the German foreign minister, who was, incredibly, at this battle. "What I saw left me speechless. From beyond the shallow rise, about 150 to 200 meters in front of me appeared 15, then 30, then 40 tanks. Finally, there are too many to count. The T-34s were rolling towards us at high speed, carrying mounted infantry." End quote. Unlike the Germans with their half-track APCs, or armored personnel carriers, Red Army infantry supporting the armor rode on top of the tanks. So, we can see that in 1943, as previously, and as continues today, the Russians use mass, sheer numbers of men and equipment, not quality, to overwhelm their opponents. Historian Antony Beaver describes the clash this way. Quote, "The battle resembled a medieval clash of armored knights. Neither artillery nor aircraft could help either side, so mixed up were the forces. Formation and control were lost on both sides, as tank fought tank at point-blank range. When ammunition and fuel blew up, the turret of the tank would be sent flying." Quote, "They were around us, on top of us, and between us," wrote an Untersturmführer, or second lieutenant, with 2nd Panzergrenadier Regiment. "We fought man to man. All German superiority in communications, movement, and gunnery was lost in chaos, noise, and smoke. The atmosphere was choking," a Soviet tank driver recorded. Quote, "I was gasping for breath with perspiration running in streams down my face." End quote. The psychological stress was immense. Again, from the Soviet tank driver, "We expected to be killed at any second." End quote. Those who were still alive and still fighting a couple of hours later were astonished. A Soviet onlooker wrote, "Tanks even rammed one another. The metal was burning." End quote. A little more from Robin Cook's Citadel, the Battle of Kursk. Quote, "Unable to interfere in this extraordinary armored brawl, the artillery on both sides held their fire. Ground attack aircraft were also denied a role, although dogfights continued overhead, and the scream of disabled aircraft plunging to earth could be heard over the constant, undifferentiated roar on the plain below Rostov's observation post." End quote. One more from Anthony Tucker Jones' book, Slaughter on the Eastern Front, the book I quoted from at the opening of this episode. "There were simply not enough Tigers and Panthers to halt the massed ranks of T-34s thrown at them. Prokhorovka was a bloodbath, with more than 700 tanks knocked out on both sides, end quote. So that's what's going on in the sort of the middle of the southern sector of the Battle of Kursk. But a little farther south, there's Army Detachment Kempf. Those units had finally, by this day, the 12th of July, they finally crossed the Donets River, and they were on their way to come up to help the SS Panzer divisions, but they were blocked by the reserve units of the 5th Guards Tank Army, so prevented from helping out. Meanwhile, in the northwest part of the battle, the SS Totenkopf, or Death's Head Division, came close to breaking through the Red Army. But again, reinforcements came in time. Again, the Soviet Union and the Russians using mass, just sheer numbers. By twilight, the rain started falling again. Both sides disengaged, pulled back from the battlefield, leaving hundreds of burned-out tanks to litter the green fields. Now, before we leave 12th July 1943, we have to back up in time to the beginning of the day and shift our view just north of the Kursk salient. And we'll do that right after this break. Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. Beyond Barbarossa is still, as far as I can tell, the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland, and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now, let's get back to Scott, exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Thanks for coming back to episode 54, the Battle of Prokhorovka, the impaling of the German army. While the Battle of Prokhorovka consumed tanks and men, if we look hundreds of kilometers north, the Soviet High Command was putting the next step of its strategy into motion. You see, the way salients work, if you take a look at the map on the webpage, there's usually a corresponding salient for the other side. So north of that bulge, the Soviet-held Kursk salient was a German salient, where the German line stuck out into Soviet territory around the city of Orel. And there was another one on the southern side around Belgorod. The sector of the front near Orel was held by the German 2nd Panzer Army. In the weeks and months leading up to the Battle of Kursk, the Soviets had not only packed the salient itself with nearly 2 million men and thousands of tanks and other armor. They had also gathered another huge force north of there. It included the 11th Guards Army, commanded by Ivan Bagramian, a name that will become more and more significant as the war continues, as well as three armies of the Bryansk Front and two more from the Central Front, commanded by Konstantin Rokossovsky. The plan for this group was to wait until the fighting in the northern part of the sector of the Kursk salient, the German 9th Army, culminated or stopped, came to a point where they couldn't go any farther, which happened on the 10th of July. During the night of 11th to 12th July, the Red Air Force flew 362 sorties against German positions around Orel. At dawn on the 12th, their dive bombers and ground attack planes hit the rear of the German 9th Army to draw their attention. Then Bagramian's artillery opened up a two-hour barrage, followed by a fast advance against Army Group Center's rear. In 2 days, the 11th Guards Army advanced more than 10 miles. And still the Red Army did not let up and fed whole new armies into that attack. And we'll get into that in the next episode. On 13 July, the day after the great tank battle at Prokhorovka, Hitler summoned the senior commanders of the Eastern Front, von Manstein and Kluge, to his headquarters at Wolfschanz, the Wolf's lair in East Prussia. The operation was off, he said. The Western Allies had just landed in Sicily in Operation Husky. Could this be the Second Front? Whatever it was, the German response needed to shift units away from the Eastern Front to deal with it. Manstein opposed this idea. He believed the Soviets were running out of tank reserves, and by continuing the fight, the Wehrmacht was close to destroying them. Just keep going a little bit farther, he said. Withdrawing, he argued, would lead to the collapse of the German lines from Belgorod south to the Black Sea. But of course, Hitler won the argument. Whether it was the right or wrong decision from the German point of view is a continuing debate among military historians. But whether moving the 2nd SS Panzer Corps west was a good idea or not, the Battle of Kursk was now over, more or less. Fighting did continue for a few more days, and it was a terrible cost to both sides. The war diary of the Wehrmacht High Command for this period reads, quote, "After the bloody struggle for the city of Stalingrad, there followed another struggle for the strongly fortified field positions, a second Verdun, followed by a third, which was supposed to make the enemy exhaust his last forces at a strategically important point. However, this Verdun swallowed up even more of our divisions in an ever more horrifying whirlpool." End quote. On the night of 13 July, Protmistrov, commander of the 5th Guards Tank Army, which was the one that had stopped the SS Panzer Corps at Prokhorovka, took Georgi Zhukov, the coordinator of the two fronts at Kursk, to the headquarters of the 29th Tank Corps. Zhukov stopped the car several times to see the results of the tank duels. Protmistrov wrote, quote, "It was an awesome scene, with battered and burned-out tanks, wrecked guns, armored personnel carriers and trucks, heaps of artillery rounds and pieces of tracks lying everywhere. Not a single blade of grass was left standing on the darkened soil." End quote. Zhukov saw where a T-34 tank had rammed a Tiger, tangling the remains of the two tanks inextricably. Quote, "This is what a head-on clash is like," Zhukov said, and took off his hat in tribute. What was the meaning, the final impact of the Battle of Kursk? Historian Evan Maudsley calls the Battle of Prokhorovka a, quote, "tactical victory for the Germans, as they inflicted much heavier losses and drove off the main Soviet counterattack," end quote. But even Maudsley admits that, quote, "Manstein and Haught did not achieve their objective at Prokhorovka, which was to break into the open operational space behind the Soviet defenses," end quote. In that sense, then, the Red Army was successful. but at great cost. The Red Army lost 340 tanks and self-propelled guns and 14 fighter planes, and 3,563 men killed, wounded, and missing in that one-day battle. The Germans lost, according to Maudsley, quote, fewer than 24 tanks and self-propelled guns, end quote. Wikipedia puts the losses at 43 to 80 tanks and guns destroyed or damaged, with 19 aircraft lost and 842 men killed, wounded, and missing. So less than a quarter of the losses compared to the Soviets, when they started out with actually less than half the forces the Soviets brought. But overall, the Battle of Kursk, of which Prokhorovka is just one day out of more than a week, was definitely a Soviet victory, one that slid directly into the Red Army's next operations, both north and south of the salient at Orel and in Kharkiv. What were the total losses? That's complicated. Calculating the number of tanks and other equipment lost in Prokhorovka or other sectors of the front gets confusing, because the Germans repaired a number of tanks and self-propelled guns that had been damaged during the fighting and returned them to the front. Apparently, the total number of operational tanks in the 4th Panzer Army, the unit in the southern sector of the Kursk salient, remained at around 530 from the 11th to the 17th of July. Overall, though, the results were devastating for both sides. The Germans lost over 54,000 men in Operation Citadel from 5th to 13th July. The Soviets, 177,847 fighters on both sectors. That's three times as many. When it comes to equipment, the Germans lost up to 323 tanks and guns, as many as the country could produce in a month, as well as 159 aircraft. In comparison to those 323 tanks and guns, the Red Army lost more than 1,900 tanks and assault guns, and anywhere from 500 to 1,000 aircraft. As I've said before, when it comes to the USSR, accurate numbers are hard to come by. Robin Cook says that the two army fronts that fought at Kursk lost half the tanks that they had brought to the battle. Even Hurrying Heinz Guderian admitted that Kursk was a decisive defeat for the Germans. The significance of the Battle of Kursk is that the Germans were stopped for the last time. Hitler had demanded that this battle be, quote, a beacon to the whole world, end quote, showing off Germany's strength and military prowess. However, Germany would not be able to replace the losses it suffered at Kursk, while the Soviet Union was quite able to do so. Indeed, Zhukov and Rokossovsky's strategy was successful. The Germans had impaled themselves on Soviet defenses. What the Battle of Kursk showed definitively was that the war in the East was now in a different phase, one where Germany was no longer able to advance. What would follow would be a string of Red Army operations and initiatives and almost continual German retreats. Because on 13 July 1943, the Red Army unleashed a massive counteroffensive, as I mentioned. This was Operation Kutuzov, and it's going to be the focus of the next episode. So keep that in mind and come back in 2 weeks for episode 55 of Beyond Barbarossa. Thank you for listening to Beyond Barbarossa, still the only English language podcast focusing on the Eastern Front of the Second World War. You can also listen to the episode on my own website, writtenword.ca, and click on the podcast button in the banner. Please consider following Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting app, and I'd really appreciate a rating on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, or wherever you listen. That really helps spread the word to others who are interested in history. Do you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, or hopefully not, a correction? Let me know. Reach out to contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. And I'm continuing that little giveaway. So everyone who sends in a question or a comment or any kind of message through one of those two channels, email contact at beyondbarbarossa.ca or the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page will get e-copies of my Eastern Front trilogy, Army of Worn Souls, Under the Nazi Heel, and Walking Out of War, and be entered in a draw for a signed paperback copy. I want to thank all who have supported the podcast through Patreon, including the latest supporters, Bill Hall, Tom Gaffney, Craig Duncan, and Elliot. Your support means a lot. Patreon supporters get early and ad-free access to episodes, plus special bonus episodes and other benefits. You too can become a supporter of this podcast at any level you choose. Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina.